Where does the impeachment inquiry go from here?
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for November 21st, we'll walk you through what's up next on Capitol Hill. Also on the show, Gordon Sondland's path to the White House has put a spotlight on the pay-to-play world of U.S. ambassadorships.
Ambassadors like Woody Johnson to the United Kingdom, Jamie McCord, the U.S. ambassador to France, they're big donors. They've already given hundreds of thousands to the 2020 re-election fund.
And while the threat of natural disasters is growing throughout the country, recovery aid is not being distributed equally.
U.S. citizens receive $26 per person per year from the federal government, while tribal citizens receive approximately $3 per person. So that's one of the gaps that we found when it comes to disaster aid.
All right, everybody, let's get started. While yesterday's hearings are a tough act to follow, today, two more key witnesses are closing out the busy week. We heard from David Holmes, a career diplomat and political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine.
Beginning in March 2019, the situation at the embassy and in Ukraine changed dramatically. Specifically, the three priorities of security, economy, and justice, and our support for Ukrainian democratic resistance to Russian aggression, became overshadowed by a political agenda promoted by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani and a cadre of officials operating with a direct channel to the White House.
And Dr. Fiona Hill, the former top Russia advisor to the Trump White House, who worked under John Bolton. Hill recounted a heated July 10th conversation she had with Bolton over Gordon Sondland and Mick Mulvaney's role in the White House's Ukraine policy.
A specific instruction was that I had to go to the lawyers, to John Eisenberg, our senior counsel for the National Security Council, to basically say, you tell Eisenberg, Ambassador Bolton told me, that I am not part of this whatever drug deal that Mulvaney and Sondland are cooking up.
What did you understand him to mean by the drug deal that Mulvaney and Sondland were cooking up?
I took it to mean investigations for a meeting.
Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering the Justice Department and the FBI. Byron, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard Dr. Hill talking about her July 10th conversation with former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Remind us the importance of that conversation.
Well, that conversation was one of many incidents that are under investigation by the Democratic-led House Intelligence Committee. Namely, that meeting was important because it was one where the two sort of different sides of the Ukrainian policymaking apparatus sort of came together in this meeting with some Ukrainian officials who were visiting Washington, D.C. The ambassador Gordon Sondland was sort of pushing this, what he described in his testimony as a quid pro quo. And you see other officials, including John Bolton and Fiona Hill, wanting to distance themselves from it.
One person whose name has come up repeatedly throughout all of the testimony is Rudy Giuliani, former U.S. mayor and, of course, Trump's personal attorney. Hill has already said in her closed-door testimony that she was alarmed by Giuliani's role in the U.S.-Ukraine policy, but she also referred to Gordon Sondland as a national security risk. What were her concerns with both of them?
Well, I think her concerns were essentially that this was an irregular channel that was possibly being manipulated by foreign officials. Indeed, she testified on Thursday the same thing, that there was this prosecutor in Ukraine who wanted to hang on to his position, and he was essentially using Rudy Giuliani and others as essentially a tool in order to hang on to his position and sort of derail U.S. policy. And I think that was what her concern was both then and now.
One of the narratives that we've seen emerge, at least from the Republicans in the House, is that of the Ukraine being the who interfered in the 2016 election. And Hill had some pretty strong words to say to that. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests. As Republicans and Democrats have agreed for decades, Ukraine is a valued partner of the United States. And it plays an important role in our national security. And as I told the committee last month, I refuse to be part of an effort to legitimize an alternate narrative that the Ukrainian government is a US adversary and that Ukraine, not Russia, attacked us in 2016. These fictions are harmful, even if they're deployed for purely domestic political purposes.
Byron, what do you make of those comments? I mean, she's clearly stating that it was not Ukraine who interfered in the 2016 election, and instead it was Russia.
Yeah, though she didn't name names, those comments were squarely aimed at the Republican allies of President Trump on the committee, who, in the course of many of these hearings, have suggested that the president may have had good reason to be concerned about what Ukraine may or may not have done in the 2016 election. And these were some very forceful comments from a top national security professional that those allegations that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election on behalf of Hillary Clinton have no real basis in reality, and that the main driver of foreign election interference was, in fact, Russia.
We also heard diplomat David Holmes talk about the July 26 phone call that he overheard between Gordon Sondland and President Trump. And Holmes says that after that, Sondland told him the president didn't care about Ukraine, but that he only cared about, quote, big stuff that benefits the president, like the, quote, Biden investigation. And that goes against the Republican narrative that President Trump only cared about Ukrainian corruption, right?
That's right. And not just did Holmes's testimony make this point, but Gordon Sondland's testimony also made this point when he said repeatedly that the thing Rudy Giuliani was interested in was not that the investigations themselves into Burisma or the Bidens were conducted, but the fact that there was an announcement of them, meaning that that was useful for sort of domestic political purposes, but the actual investigations were not something that Rudy Giuliani was tremendously concerned about. And so this does go to the heart of the Democratic case, that this is not concern about corruption. It is, in fact, they were looking for a talking point for the 2020 election about Biden and his son's activities abroad.
Well, here's where it gets even more interesting. We heard yesterday in Gordon Sondland's testimony that Sondland repeatedly said that he did not realize that an investigation into Burisma was also an investigation into the Bidens. He made that clear in his testimony. Daniel Goldman, counsel, today brought up the same issue between Hill and Holmes. Let's hear a clip from from that exchange.
Ambassadors Volker and Sondland have tried to draw a distinction between their understanding of the connection between Burisma and the Bidens. But Dr. Hill, was it apparent to you that when President Trump, Rudy Giuliani, or anyone else was pushing for an investigation into Burisma, that the reason why they wanted that investigation related to what President Trump said here, the Bidens?
It was very apparent to me that that was what Rudy Giuliani intended, yes. Intended to convey that Burisma was linked to the Bidens, and he said this publicly, repeatedly.
And Mr. Holmes, you also understood that Burisma was code for Bidens?
Yes.
And do you think that anyone involved in Ukraine matters in the spring and the summer would understand that as well?
Yes.
So, Byron, yesterday in Sondland's testimony, he kept referring to the fact that everyone was in the loop. It seems like when it comes to whether Burisma was a direct connection to the Bidens, it seems like there was a disconnect there. How significant is this contradiction we're hearing here from Hill and Holmes to what Sondland said yesterday?
Well, it's very significant because a number of these officials, as you've noted, including Gordon Sondland and Kurt Volker and others, have tried to distance themselves from this idea that they knew very early that the president and others were referring to the Bidens when they were using the term Burisma. And, you know, Rudy Giuliani and others made no secret as early as May or even before that, that they wanted this investigation into corruption, that it was directly linked to Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and his role on the board of this energy company. So it does go to show that, you know, a lot of this was public a long time ago and that most of the people who were paying attention to Ukraine policy understood exactly what was going on.
And of course, it has come up in testimony that with a simple Google search for Burisma, you would clearly see that Hunter Biden was at least part of the board of directors there. Democratic counsel Goldman, again, seemed to be tying some of these theories about Ukraine's involvement in the 2016 election directly to Putin. Let's take a listen to that exchange.
And Dr. Hill, by promoting this theory of Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election, was President Trump adopting Vladimir Putin's view over his own senior advisors and intelligence officials?
I think we have to be very careful about the way that we phrase that. This is a view that President Putin and the Russian security services and many actors in Russia have promoted. But I think that this view has also got some traction, perhaps in parallel and separately here in the United States. And those two things have, over time, started to fuse together.
Byron, what stood out to you in that exchange? Because we know, for example, to bring up another moment in history here, in the Mueller report, it was clearly stated there that there was interference in our 2016 election. So what stood out to you about that exchange?
Well, I think what she was saying there was essentially that this sort of alternative narrative that it was Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election or may have interfered or allegedly interfered benefits Russia, which has consistently denied anything to do with election interference, even though every body of the U.S. government, including the House Intelligence Committee, has concluded that there was some sort of election interference. Now, the scope of that interference or what their aims were, that's still disputed. But no one who has looked at this really disputes that Russia interfered in the 2016 election.
Rudy Giuliani has not been on television at much, but he was vocal on Twitter yesterday during Gordon Sondland's testimony. What was his what did he have to say, Byron?
I actually didn't catch what Giuliani said, but essentially, I mean, the case he's been making is in public is that nothing was wrong here and that, you know, he's not responsible for any of what's going on.
You know, one of the things that comes up a lot in this is whether or not, despite what the case is that the Democrats are laying out, whether or not that's going to affect the Republican strategy at all, whether they're going to reshape their talking points or not. Devin Nunes has essentially said his opening statement has been very similar for each of these witnesses. So I'm wondering, do you see any of this having any effect whatsoever on the Republican strategy going forward?
Well, the Republican strategy has actually changed a little bit over time. At first, they were making process arguments, and now they seem to be moving towards defending the president on substance. But it remains to be seen exactly how they're going to handle some of these very damaging allegations that witnesses who have paraded before their committee are making about the president's conduct and the U.S. policy towards Ukraine.
Any sense when we might actually see articles of impeachment drafted up?
I think Democrats have said they'd like to do this by the end of the year, though that timeline is quite ambitious, and we're coming up on that right now.
Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering the Justice Department and the FBI. Byron, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, some people say that is guilty.
That is guilty.
Some people say that they don't know.
I don't know.
Some people say let's give him a chance.
Give him a chance.
Or some people say wait till he's convicted.
Till he's convicted.
Impeach the president.
Impeach the president.
Ambassador Gordon Sondland has been at the center of this week's impeachment proceedings. While the witnesses before him were all career diplomats with extensive track records in foreign service, Sondland is a wealthy West Coast hotelier who donated $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee, which helped him land his ambassadorship. Sondland's leading role at the heart of this saga has put a new focus on the long-standing bipartisan practice of political appointments to overseas posts.
Ambassadors like Woody Johnson to the United Kingdom, Jamie McCourt, the U.S. ambassador to France, they're big donors. They've already given hundreds of thousands to the 2020 re-election fund. There are people like Robin Bernstein in the Dominican Republic, Lana Marks in South Africa. They belong to Mar-a-Lago. That's $200,000 a joint.
That was Jim Axelrod, chief investigative and senior national correspondent for CBS News. CBS recently uncovered emails from San Diego billionaire Doug Manchester, who was nominated to be the ambassador to the Bahamas. Manchester had clear support from President Trump, but his nomination was held up in the Senate for more than 2 years. And then in September, the Republican National Committee reached out.
The head of the RNC, Ronna McDaniel, sends Doug Manchester an email, and it asks him for a $500,000 donation.
Manchester responded to the RNC and was very clear about what he wanted in exchange for his donation.
So he says, as you know, I'm not supposed to do any, but my wife is sending a contribution for $100,000. Remember, they've been asked for $500,000. Assuming I get voted out of the Foreign Relations Committee on Wednesday to the floor, we need you to have the majority leader to bring it to a majority vote. Once confirmed, our family will respond.
And once Congress found out about his email, the White House asked Manchester to withdraw his name from consideration. Manchester's example might seem extreme, but the transactional nature of these appointments is not that unusual when it comes to presidents naming ambassadors. But under the Trump administration, the number of political supporters who've been appointed to ambassadorships has gone up significantly. For more on this, I'm joined by Ryan Scovel, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by Ambassador Dennis Jett, Professor of International Affairs at Penn State and author of the book American Ambassadors, The Past, Present, and Future of America's Diplomats. Welcome to The Takeaway, Dennis.
Thank you for having me.
Ryan, let's start with you. We said at the top that political ambassadorships aren't a new phenomenon. How far back does this trend go?
Well, it extends almost as far back as the founding of the country itself. These types of appointments were extremely common during the 19th century, and they remained common through the beginning of the 20th century. Since roughly the 1920s, 1930s, the percentage of political appointees has dropped pretty significantly to the point where over the last several decades, it's been approximately 30% of all ambassadorships. But the history is pretty longstanding.
Ambassador Jett, we mentioned that these appointments are growing under President Trump quite a bit. You have worked in foreign service for decades. You've worked in Argentina, Malawi, Liberia, Mozambique. Why is this pay-to-play system, if you will, so troubling for the Foreign Service?
Well, I think it's expected that the president will name a certain amount of ambassadors, political appointee ambassadors, as opposed to career Foreign Service officers. But I think what troubles me and other officers is when it's done on the basis of money. If there's some obviously qualified person who has the credentials to be an ambassador, that's one thing. But if you have a real estate developer who gives $1 million and gets the post because of that's something else.
What is it about these posts that hold such allure for wealthy donors, Ambassador? Because I can imagine, if you're a young person looking to get into a career in foreign service, it could be, really exciting to think you'll be traveling around the world in all these posts that I just mentioned. But if you've already got a pretty significant stash of wealth, why Ambassador?
Well, it's a fancy title. It's something you put on your business card and your resume, and nobody has to remember your name after that. They all call you ambassador. And so for people with a lot of money and a low self-esteem or whatever their problem is, they can buy the title.
Ambassador, do these political appointees, other than the fact that this is a fancy title and it has a lot of accolades and mystery around it, they're actually, depending on your ambassadorship, you actually have to get stuff done. If you're not qualified to do that work, does that have the potential to do damage to the U.S.'s relationship with whatever country you might be stationed in?
Absolutely. And I think it's a danger to national security when these people are nominated and approved as ambassadors. If you suggested that you're going to turn over the command of an aircraft carrier to a real estate developer because of a political contribution, everybody would go nuts. But if you turn over an embassy to a similar kind of person, then people say, it's a diplomacy. It's, that's endless cocktail parties and not paying parking tickets. But the reality is you have to manage a complex organization, the embassy, and we'd like to think that the better our government functions, the better off we all are. And secondly, you are the United States. You're the number one representative in the country you're in. And so people look to you and reach conclusions about the United States, about its reliability, about its seriousness, based on the image you project and how well you do the job.
Ryan, you looked at the qualifications of political appointees, and I'm wondering if you could share with us whether or not there's a connection between how much money they donated, how wealthy the person is, and what position they end up receiving.
Well, there has been a pretty significant development in qualifications over time. If you were to compare the political appointees under Trump and Reagan, for example, you'd find that there's been an erosion across the board. That is, Trump's political appointees are not the same as the political appointees that have been taking place under prior administrations. They're not radically different, but there's been an incremental decrease in qualifications. And that's true not only with respect to language abilities, prior experience in the receiving state or the region, but also with respect to prior experience in foreign policy, prior experience in organizational leadership. So there has been a very noticeable downward trajectory here in terms of the average qualifications of the political appointees who make it into office. There is one study that has found that there's about a 10% decrease in the performance in office if you were to compare political appointees with career appointees. That is, the political appointees are less successful. And there's also evidence that there's a confluence of two significant trends here. One, a decrease in qualifications over time, and then two, alongside that, a sharp increase in the average size of campaign contributions. And this raises the possibility that campaign contributions are, you know, effectively creating pressure on the president to choose individuals based on how much money they're giving rather than whether they're qualified to serve. And that in turn, you know, creates the possibility that performance is essentially falling off as a result of these pressures to look for individuals who are contributing a lot of money.
Ambassador Jett, this is not a new tradition, as we've been saying throughout the segment. This is something that has happened under multiple administrations. It has seen an increase under the Trump administration. But the part of the reason we're talking about this is because the United States citizens yesterday watched Ambassador Sondland testify. And he, unlike many of the folks who came before him, is not a career Foreign Service employee or diplomat. He was a donor of $1 million to the Trump campaign. So what was your assessment of how he conducted himself with respect to Ukraine?
Well, Ambassador Sondland is as qualified to be ambassador as I am to run a chain of hotels. He clearly doesn't get it. He said yesterday, I'm not a note taker. I have all these conversations with heads of state and other important people, but I don't bother to take notes. When you are an official of the United States government, you are speaking not on your own behalf, but on behalf of the American people and the American government. And therefore, you have an obligation to do things like take notes so you know what commitments are being made, what's being said, and that policy is properly implemented. And so I think he's just the latest demonstration of somebody who's completely out of their depth, even though he was sitting there smirking the whole time and obviously thinks because of his wealth, he's entitled to be arrogant as well as incompetent.
Ryan, just wrapping up the segment here, we saw this issue play out for those who did not tire of politics yesterday and watched the Democratic presidential debate that came after the testimony. Let's listen to a clip of Elizabeth Warren and how she brought this up.
How did Ambassador Sondland get there? You know, this is not a man who had any qualifications except one. He wrote a check for $1 million. The whole notion that donors think they're going to get ambassadorships on the other side. Anyone who wants to give me a big donation, don't ask to be an ambassador because I'm not going to have that happen.
Ryan, we've got 30 seconds. Is this going to take off in 2020 as a political issue?
I would like to think so. I'm a little bit skeptical, in part because this has been a recurring political issue over the course of the past several decades. It seems to pop up any time there's a controversial appointment. I would like to think that Congress could step in here to take action and that presidential candidates themselves will repeat this promise, but I'm not sure.
We will see. I'm speaking with Ryan Scovel, Associate Professor of Law at Marquette University, and Ambassador Dennis Coleman Jett, Professor of International Affairs at Penn State. Thanks to you both.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. $255 million of funding for minority-serving institutions, including historically black colleges and universities, is being held up in the Senate. The money is intended specifically to keep their science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM programs, afloat. Federal fundings for these programs expired on September 30th. And while there's been overwhelming bipartisan support for this funding, Democrats and Republicans disagree on the logistics of how it should be passed. Joining me now is Erica L. Green, an education reporter with the New York Times. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the holdup here in the Senate?
The holdup is that there is an effort by a Republican lawmaker, Lamar Alexander, Senator of Tennessee, who has been intent to get packages of the Higher Education Act passed. He feels very strongly that there will never be a comprehensive overhaul for this federal law, which is outdated. And he saw an opportunity to use the HBCU funding, which does have bipartisan support, to introduce several other packages that have bipartisan support to get them all passed. And Democrats don't believe that that's the way to go. They believe that this funding should be passed in a standalone bill and that they should deal with other parts of the more comprehensive law separately.
How many students are we talking about in terms of the ones who would benefit from this funding?
Between all of the colleges, which are HBCUs, tribal colleges, and Hispanic-serving institutions, it's about 4 million students who are attending these institutions across the country in all 50 states.
I mean, HBCUs generally, at least, have been struggling to different degrees with funding. How are they preparing for this delay in funding for STEM?
From what our reporting suggests, HBCUs have, you know, the planning for this funding and the programs that it supports have come to a halt. They have stopped, you know, extending job offers to candidates in the STEM field, which are very difficult to recruit and to retain. They have canceled contracts for any work that they have planned to renovate their laboratories, classrooms, to get supplies, all of these kind of support measures that they need to keep their programs up and running, at least to be high quality. They have stopped going to the education department to get approval to spend any funding because the education department cannot authorize funding for a program that is no longer authorized. In the most extreme cases, some college presidents are having conversations with staff whose salaries are supported by this funding to inform them that they may not be back next school year.
What are the wider implications to this lack of funding?
I mean, as you mentioned, HBCUs have dealt with chronic underfunding for decades and decades. That puts them at a disadvantage when it comes to competing for staff and students. And for them, a lot of them feel that they have been able to get some momentum, at least in this particular field. They really fear the loss of that momentum. You know, they are producing pipelines of Black, Hispanic professionals in the STEM field where those populations are woefully underrepresented. They are producing Black doctors, which we all know there is a shortage of across the country, and that impacts, you know, marginalized communities.
In terms of the HBCU landscape under the Trump administration, what has that relationship been like thus far?
Well, that's interesting. It has actually been a good relationship. the HBCUs, they have always been clear that they will work with anybody. And they believe in working on both sides of the aisle, not just for, you know, goodwill, but also because a large swath of HBCUs are located in southern states, have enjoyed the support of Republican and Democratic lawmakers. For the HBCUs, as long as they have the support of Congress, even better, the White House, they have been willing to work with anybody. And they've been very, very outspoken about that.
Erica Green is an education reporter for The New York Times. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There are so many people there living in hotels who can't go back to work because their job was taken from them by the storm.
The tens of thousands of fires that have been burning so far this month mark at least a 10-year high.
I couldn't get a hold of my parents, hadn't talked to my mom in over an hour. Their house phone is completely dead.
Right after Hurricane Maria, the tourism industry in Puerto Rico was actually completely shut down.
I have not experienced anything quite like this as an adult.
It looked like Armageddon. We literally had to drive through a wall of flames just to get out.
We hear a lot about natural disasters these days. Everything from fires to hurricanes can lead to billions of dollars in damages for communities across the United States. In 2019, weather and climate disasters resulted in billions of dollars worth of losses. But indigenous communities tend to get far less aid from the federal government than states do. That's according to a new analysis by the Center for Public Integrity and High Country News. While U.S. citizens on average receive $26 per person from the federal government, tribal citizens only get about $3 per person per year. And because of fewer resources and unemployment, tribal nations are more vulnerable than the U.S. overall when a natural disaster strikes. I spoke to Allison Herrera, a member of the Xolan Tzilinin tribe from the central coast of California, and a freelance reporter for High Country News.
Over the last decade, there were 70 natural disasters that occurred on tribal lands. And we also found that, you know, from data from the National Congress of American Indians, those citizens that live on tribal lands are more vulnerable overall than U.S. citizens because of factors of like unemployment and income. And we also found that U.S. citizens receive $26 per person per year from the federal government, while tribal citizens receive approximately $3 per person. So that's one of the gaps that we found when it comes to disaster aid, looking at tribal communities versus a community that is in a state that is not a tribal community.
And let's give some examples, specific examples of reservations that have been hit hard by natural disasters in recent years.
One is the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation. In the last 10 years, they had four natural disasters. They had severe storms, straight line winds, flooding, and fires. In 2015, 255,000 acres of their land were burned. That's approximately 20% of the tribe's land base. And some of their housing was wiped out during that period of time, yet they were ineligible for individual assistance to help rebuild those homes. And those homes were rebuilt with some help from the neighboring Tulalip tribe. Another thing that happened in 2018, they had severe flooding that caused nearly $500,000 in damage.
So we know that there are reservations that have been hit pretty hard by natural disasters. How does it compare when you're in a tribal community requesting funding from the federal government to what someone outside of a tribal community would do to request funding from the federal government when it comes to FEMA, for example?
The process is, by all accounts, similar, except that tribes have to have this thing called disaster mitigation plan. States also have to have that plan. But the difference is that, you know, those plans, they have to meet certain requirements, but it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of specialized personnel. The process to approve contractors to put together this plan takes a long time because tribal governments run differently. And also, sometimes they don't have the staff to put that together. So Sometimes they don't have the money to be able to hire those contractors. They can get a grant from FEMA to do that, but then again, that's another process. FEMA leaders that I have talked with in the community, like Nelson Andrews Jr., who's the emergency management for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, said it's just kind of a separate but unequal system.
I mean, it's very unequal given the dollar amounts that you've cited at the top of the piece. Like, why is there such a difference in how much tribes tend to get on average than folks who are not living on tribal lands?
You know, tribal communities are smaller compared to, you know, citizens that live in, you know, the state of Minnesota or the state of North Dakota. But at the same time, that's per capita. I mean, that is such a smaller amount. I think the problem that I've heard from leaders is just the process by which funding is obtained. For instance, I cited the fact that you have to front the costs. So a tribe has to pay for that $500,000 in damage. And FEMA doesn't only, they reimburse up to 70%. The tribe has to pay for the other 30 out of pocket. And so that 70% that you get reimbursed for, like in the example of Colville, in that 2018 flooding, they're still waiting on the reimbursement. And that is because some of the paperwork was not coded properly. And that goes to staffing issues. I mean, so a state has a department that can, their whole job is dedicated to coding that paperwork, making sure that it's accurate. While a tribal community, a tribal government, they have to shift people around. They don't have that one person that does that. And so that creates a lot of delay. So it's that process, and it's also just having that hazard mitigation plan. Right now, out of the 573 federally recognized tribes, according to Nelson Andrews Jr., who's the emergency management person for what Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, only 30% of tribes have a disaster mitigation plan. And that leaves you really vulnerable and very, very exposed.
So what can tribes do, or are tribes trying to do anything to change that?
I know that next year at the National Congress of American Indians is going to be lobbying for an increase in funding for disaster aid. They want $20 million more annually in additional funding for tribal grants for the next 5 years to help tribes assist on that technical level when we're talking about the paperwork. We're not talking about people that are to train people to know how to do that, train people on how to do that. And I think that comes with some lobbying and just some awareness on the part of, you know, the needs that tribes have.
Allison Herrera is a member of the Jolon-Salinan tribe from the central coast of California and a freelance reporter for High Country News. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thank you so much, Tanzina.
The crew that makes this show is just fantastic, and I want to read their names to you. Our senior producers are Amber Hall and Alexander Boti, and they lead our producer team, Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Jivika Varma, Andres O'Hara, Temi Fogg-Benle, Joseph Gedeon, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Pali Irungu and Dina Saeed Ahmed are our digital editors. Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry are our board operators. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. David Gable is our baby Yoda and executive assistant. And Lita Halliwell is our intern. A huge special thanks to Lee Hill, who's back with us in the trenches for a while. And Deirdre Depke is our executive producer. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. And of course, you can give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you Monday.